100% born in the Appalachian Mountains and made in the USA, Timber Ninja Outdoors provides a range of mobile hunting options to accommodate diverse hunting preferences. Whether you prioritize comfort, lightweight design, or versatility, their two-panel and single-panel saddles collection has something for everyone. The Black Belt Nano is the lightest single-panel saddle available on the market, weighing in under a pound. The saddle is designed with the minimalist hunter in mind, focusing on lightweight functionality and breathability. One notable feature is the patent-pending magnetic stick clip system on the side, which allows for convenient transportation of sticks up the tree, as well as a built-in platform holder. The Nano saddle can be folded up to the size of a Nalgene bottle, enabling easy portability. With a four-way stretch material on the back for a comfortable fit, as well as strategically placed padding for hip pinch relief, you can use code EASTMEETSWEST to get free shipping on any Timber Ninja order. If you try it out and don't like it, send it back within 30 days for a full refund. Learn more at TimberNinjaOutdoors.com and sign up for their email newsletter for exclusive discounts and product drops. When it comes to optics, I get the same question over and over again. What are the best all-around binoculars? Well, it's tough to find something that works in every condition great, but after using a pair of Maven B1.2 10x42s, I think I found them. They feature an 8x or a 10x option, superior low light performance, tack sharp edge-to-edge clarity, a generous depth of field, and a silky focus mechanism. All of Maven Optics have a lifetime no-fault warranty and hail from the great state of Wyoming. I've been using Maven Optics since I bought my first pair in 2017, and I think you should test them out for yourself. Head over to mavenbelt.com and use the code EASTMEETSWEST-GIFT for a free gift with any full-price optics order. For all of those that want a truck bed cover for work or play, Diamondback makes the top-of-the-line, heavy-duty covers that help you do more with your truck. They're perfect for the truck-owning, avid sportsmen, outdoor enthusiasts, and weekend project warriors. I'm currently using the HD cover that is capable of holding up to 1,600 pounds on the top. And then I have the Yakima Overhaul HD bars on top so I can put my rooftop tent on it. When I'm not using my rooftop tent and able to use the trifold design of the Diamondback, I have the Crossbin 8 in there to organize all of my stuff in the back of my truck bed. Diamondback is made right here in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. If you want to check them out, head over to diamondbackcovers.com. If you've wanted that hunting camp tradition that we talk about, that experience, but you don't have a hunting camp of your own, you're welcome to come stay at my hunting camp up here in the Pennsylvania Wilds called the Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds. So if you go over to Airbnb, you can check out our three-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath house that's right in the heart of Pennsylvania elk country. It's only minutes away from a bunch of public land to be able to hunt, hiking trails, outdoor recreation, fishing, all of those things there. The house is completely fully stocked with everything that you need to be able to spend a week hunting deer, taking your family up to see the elk, anything like that. So if you head over to Airbnb and search Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds, you'll find my listing there and you can rent out my house. Send us a message, an inquiry that you're interested in it and mention that you heard it on the podcast here. Then we'll get you 10% off of your first stay.
Are you an adventurer looking to take your hunt to the next level? Then you're in the right place. Welcome to East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the East Meets West Hunt podcast presented by Spartan Forge. On today's episode, I am joined by Anthony Twan Dickman, former Navy SEAL, Kurt Martonic, gunsmith, and Drew Carroll of Seek One. We recently completed the Guardian Precision long-range shooting course in Alabama and sat down to talk about the takeaways from the course, how Twan's SEAL team background has helped him in tough situations, how consistency leads to accuracy, dealing with high-stress situations, and much more. On this week's Mountain Buck Monday Story of the Week, we have a story coming from Pennsylvania from Al Burke. And I had to summarize this a little bit. It was a really, really good story, but it's a little bit too long to be able to fit in this. So I'm going to summarize a little bit of it, but such a great story here from Al, and love the family aspect too as well. So in the summer of 2022, we got some pictures of a huge, unique buck on camera. We couldn't believe our eyes. He had 3 drop tines and at least 17 points in August. We thought we were dreaming when we checked the camera card. After showing my brother-in-law a photo of the buck, he immediately said, "That thing looked like a bushwhacker." And the name stuck. Bushwhacker, he was called from then on. In mid-November, while bow hunting, he showed up at 30 yards in the brush right in front of my 16-year-old son, Dustin. He appeared at a bad angle and could not get a shot at him. I nearly jumped out of my tree stand when I got his text. We couldn't believe this buck was still around. Dustin had another opportunity at an 8-point only a couple minutes after seeing Bushwhacker, but thought it was best just to take his phone out and video the smaller buck. That was the only time that we saw him on that 2-day hunt. Now came the hardest part, convincing my wife to let Dustin and I go up to again to the farm for the opening morning of rifle season 2 weeks later. She decided I could go, only if I took almost all the kids with me. I was up for the challenge. We have 8 children, and my wife stayed home with our youngest of 5 months and my oldest daughter. I took the middle 6 children with me. They were so excited to go up and have the experience to hunt at our family farm. On opening morning, all of a sudden, I heard a snap. I turn my head and see a buck with his nose to the ground. I whip around, put the rifle on my shoulder. As I look in the direction of where the buck is, I don't see anything at all. Then out of nowhere, I see a buck coming out from behind a tree with his nose to the ground at 40 yards. All I know is it looks like a legal buck with some mass. I immediately see him buckle and start snow plowing the ground after the shot. I immediately call my son, who is in the stand less than 300 yards away from me, and tell him I just shot a buck. I followed the trail for only 40 yards and found the buck lying there. As I walked up to him, it was unreal. I see stickers and points sticking out in every direction. It hits me immediately. It's Bushwhacker. I yelled to Dustin, and he came running. We head back to the house to get all the little kids and go right into the woods and surprise them. They were all joking that I'd probably shot Bushwhacker. And sure enough, there he was. The expressions on their faces when they saw him were so cool to see. Some of his drop tines had been broken off, but that didn't matter. It was those moments I was privileged to spend with all 6 of my children as we dragged Bushwhacker out of the woods into the field. It's a time I will never forget. Well, that's a pretty awesome story, Al, and just an incredible, incredible deer. I mean, for Pennsylvania especially, but for really anywhere in the country, and for that to be able to happen like that, and just a really unique, cool mountain buck. And for anyone who wants to check it out, head over to East Meets West Hunt on Instagram or East Meets West Outdoors on Facebook, and you can see the photo of this buck along with the story as well. So head over and check that out. If you have your own Mountain Buck Monday story, send it into my email, bo@eastmeetswesthunt.com. Just a couple paragraphs and 2, 3, 4 pictures, whatever you have available. Would love to be able to share it with the rest of the audience here. So thanks for everyone that's been submitting them up to this point. All right, another news just quickly. I am, as of the day of release on this, I am heading to Alaska. So I'm heading out and I will be... I won't be able to respond or get any texts, calls, anything for the next couple of weeks as I'll be moose hunting in Alaska. And I'm really looking forward to that. So I appreciate the patience on getting back to you there. Orders on the website, so all the apparel orders, everything like that, will still be going out. Maybe slightly delayed. Won't ship, you know, kind of the same day or two as normal. But I do have someone helping me out with that while I'm gone this time. So I appreciate that. And I also have a special kind of promotion there. I'd shared a little teaser on Instagram about a month ago where I had some custom East Meets West hats done on Sika Subalpine hats and Sika Elevated 2 camo pattern hats with a really cool leather patch that was done here in Pennsylvania. And they turned out really, really good. And so what I'm going to be doing with these hats is I'm not going to be selling them. I'm going to be giving them away. And all the details are over on the website. But essentially, you get free East Meets West Sika hat with any order over $60 off of the website, not including shipping. So if you prefer Subalpine or Elevated 2, just make sure you put that in the order notes And if not, I'll just send you whatever one comes out of the box first. But really excited for these. They turned out really, really good. And yeah, but they're available now. So by the time you hear this, you can head over and it'll only go for as long as supplies last. I'm also holding some back for some other different giveaways and stuff, but they turned out awesome. So thanks everybody for being a big supporter of the podcast here and everything else that comes into this. So I hope you enjoy this, and I think you'll really like this podcast with the guys at the Guardian Precision Shooting Course. And if you want to check them out, go over to Instagram, Guardian Precision, and give them a follow. Have a great rest of your week. So we have a kind of a special podcast here. It's going to be kind of a collaboration with Seek One.
Little tag team
and East Meets West. So kind of doing a collaboration podcast here.
Yeah, it kind of makes me feel uncomfortable because I really wanted to distance Seek One from the East Meets West brand, basically of who you are. But, I mean, we're kind of stuck in the situation, so we'll roll with it.
Yeah, you really didn't have a choice here, Drew. We only have so much time, and I figured that, we could join together. Because honestly, I really don't want to be combined with, the suburban deer hunters either.
Yeah. Posers.
The high fence hunters.
Helicopter hunters.
Helicopter
Which honestly, hunters. These relationships we've built this week are really going to come in handy, because I feel like these guys probably have Apaches and Blackhawks on speed dial. So.
Yeah.
It's gonna bring the bucks in a lot faster for us.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of go around here and introduce some of the guys we have here. So we got Drew, obviously, from Seek One, and then we have my brother Kurt that has been on the podcast before, at least on my podcast before. Gunsmith, works for Spartan Forge, kind of the whole gamut there.
Does all the cool things that Bo doesn't do.
Yeah, if you.
I'm just going to totally derail this whole podcast. It's probably a bad idea to bring me on.
Yeah.
Plays guitar.
Has an amazing voice. Better shooter.
It's, yeah, no.
Oh. Yeah, no, I'm definitely not a better shooter.
Well, that part. That part, yeah.
And then we have our friend Anthony Dickman, otherwise known as Twan.
Twan.
Can we go by Twan?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, cool. Well, Twan, welcome to the show here. It's been pretty cool. We're in Alabama, going through a long range shooting course through Guardian Precision, which is your guys' company, and to be able to go through it. So that's pretty excited to go through it. We're just finishing up the day two and kind of completing that.
Yeah, no, it's been
more like day one and a half.
Yeah,
the weather's been rough.
Yeah, pretty took a little bit for all of us to get here.
It did. Everyone's flights got delayed, bad thunderstorms, but I feel like it was realistic conditions, because it's pretty rare that you go out and hunt
we shot a lot in the rain today, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that was pretty awesome to be able to see that. And yeah, so we got derailed. Apparently Atlanta just had some bad storms and we couldn't come in, and it was kind of cool to watch how you guys adapted to the whole situation. It's just kind of like, I mean, I'm sure with as we'll get into a little bit, but as you know, your profession that you grew up doing in the SEAL teams and being able to do that, adapting to situations and just figuring it out, you didn't get rattled. You're just like, all right, we'll just adapt and figure it out. And poor Josh Ilderton from the Untamed. Josh
took like 6 days to get here. But if anyone's gonna make it here, it was him.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure he just ended up hitchhiking all the way down here.
I'm pretty sure he did too.
I think there was, it felt like there was a lot of days that passed in like a couple days, because
it was
what should have been 5 or 6 hours of travel turned into staying overnight in hotels, and for Josh, even more than that.
yeah. It took him quite a while to be able to come here. But so I had met Twan through a mutual friend, and I got to spend a little bit of time hunting with you in the past and stuff, and getting to learn a little bit about you. And when you guys came to me about doing a course, you know, you grew up, I mean, did you grow up hunting?
I did not. I didn't start hunting till I came into the Navy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. No, so you,
and of all places, I started hunting in Hawaii.
That's an awesome place to start hunting.
Yeah,
it's a target-rich environment.
Yes and no.
What part of Hawaii are you from? Well, where were you in?
Well, I was on Oahu.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do they have access to your goat?
Not on Oahu.
No.
No. On Oahu, they had hogs, goats.
Yeah.
Like wild goats.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a few birds, pheasants, chuckers, stuff like that. So I started hunting hogs and goats, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Feral animals.
So we went and hunted lanai last year. We hunted lanai for access deer, and then we went over to the Big Island.
Yeah.
And didn't really plan on hunting goats. It was kind of like a last minute thing. Like we had some extra time and we had hunted axis deer, then pigs. And then we had like two extra days. So we're like, okay, I guess we should hunt goats. And we've been driving around the island and seeing just piles and piles of goats up in the lava fields. And that ended up being like the most fun hunt of the entire trip. Just like going up into that black, crazy black rock. It was literally like you're hunting an asteroid.
Yeah. It's actually a pretty tough hunt.
Yeah,
because even on Oahu, which isn't, it's not, you know, the terrain isn't super hard, but it's still a pretty tough hunt.
Yeah.
To hunt those feral goats, and the goats are an introduced animal to Hawaii that are eating the native plants and destroying the native habitat basically.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, year round season, kill as many as you want to kill, type of thing.
There's plenty of them.
Yeah,
that's for sure. Yeah. I mean, we were hunting one spot, and it was actually a abandoned golf course on the Big Island, but most of it was like lava field, and there had to have been like 300 of them in a group out there. It's wild.
How many did you get?
I killed two off of that place, and then the day before I killed one off a different place. But I mean, we actually had to catch a flight. I got on the flight, and I still had like goat blood and just reeked of goat getting on the plane. And we barely made the flight. But I mean, you could sit up there and just pick them off. It's honestly like really, really good practice for an off season deal. Yeah. Just you get so many stalks in, and just, you know, there's so many targets that if you blow one stalk, you can just go to the next one and hunt fresh animals. Yeah. So
did you get any access here?
We did. So we took the bows with us. We were trying to kill one with a bow and spent the first couple days shooting at axis deer with our bows. And it was, so when we went, apparently it's typically very windy. And so you have like that sound cover and that movement cover of just like the lantana is what they call it out there, just moving, and it's easier to stalk. But it was bone dry and dead still. And so every time we shot, the deer were just gone before the arrow even got there.
Hmm.
So ended up breaking the rifles out on the third day, and we both shot bucks with the rifle.
Nice. I've hunted the axis deer out there, but I've never killed one out there.
Yeah. They're hard to kill.
Yeah. I heard that they're super jumpy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they are. I mean, they get hunted day and night, 24/7, 365 on lanai from guys that are going out there on outfitted hunts and on like there's people that just do management. They just shoot them because there's too many of them, basically. So, but yeah, it's a cool place.
Oh, interesting. So yeah, you talked about like a little bit how, you know, you didn't grow up hunting, but you kind of started doing that in Hawaii. But talk a little bit about, if you would, Tuan, just kind of about your career and kind of how you got to this point. And, you know, I feel like there's a bunch of different courses out there and different things as far as shooting goes. But what I thought was super interesting in what you guys were doing and what we experienced here over the last couple of days was just that you had so much experience as a sniper in the SEAL teams, you know, over 30 years of experience. And just being able to have that kind of experience in training over so many years and then becoming an instructor and then also having hunting experience and all these different things to be able to apply it. And, you know, your idea kind of behind the course and everything that we're doing and other people have the opportunity to be able to do is essentially to be able to shoot effectively out to 600 yards, but, you know, be able to make you better at closer distances as well. But kind of wanted to hear, that was kind of a long way of hear a background on you and kind of how you got to this point in your training and everything.
Okay. So I grew up, my father was in the Army, so I grew up pretty much all over the world. Lived in Germany, Korea. My mom's half Korean. All over the South, you know, different Army bases. My dad retired in 79-80, so he decided to move to Colorado. So we ended up in Colorado, went to high school in Colorado, went to the University of Colorado for college, and then enlisted in the Navy in 1991 and went to BUDS, graduated from BUDS, and my first team was, it's called SEAL Delivery Vehicle Team 1, which is the mini submarines. My actual first school that I went to was sniper school. I went to sniper school as a brand new guy, which pretty unheard of back then. I mean, there were guys in the teams for years wanting to go to sniper school that didn't have a chance to. And I'm a brand new guy, show up to the team, just walking down the hall, and somebody's like, "Hey, you want to go to sniper school?" I was like, "Oh, hell yeah, I want to go to sniper school." So anyway, back then sniper school was, it was a West Coast sniper school and an East Coast sniper school. Now there's only one sniper school for NSW, but back then the West Coast had their own. So went to sniper school as a new guy and pretty much got beat every day for going to sniper school as a new guy. I mean, there were dudes that were not happy that I went to sniper school as a brand new, you know, guy that just showed up to the team. But anyway, went to sniper school, did a couple platoons at SDV. So I started out in Coronado with SDVs, and then the whole team moved to Hawaii, and that's how I was in Hawaii. And then from there, I went to SEAL Team 4, and then SEAL Team 8, and then screened for Naval Special Warfare Development Group, got accepted to go through the training, made it through the training, stayed there for, you know, 14, 15 years, and then left there to go to the training detachment, which trains the East Coast SEAL teams. And I retired in 2021. So I had 30 years.
I just want to kind of express like my perception of just getting to know you in the first 24 hours of meeting you. I know it's kind of like a sticky situation being a SEAL and then kind of going into civilian world and like trying to figure out like what do you do with all these skills that you've developed over these 30 years. And it's, I know that it can kind of give yourself this stigma of like, I don't know if selling out is the right term, but it can kind of have that perception, I guess, in the teams.
Yeah.
And I've just been extremely like appreciative and impressed of like how you guys have been just silent professionals. Like you probably didn't want to go on the podcast. Like you guys are extremely humble, just getting to know you guys for just a short amount of time. And I don't know if I have, like, I don't have a good perspective just being like a regular civilian, but from my perspective, like you guys have put in the time, like you've made the sacrifice, you've served our country and you've developed these skills over all these years. And like, it would be honestly, I just think it's like almost your duty to pass on these skills to guys that want to take a course like this. And it's, you'll probably catch some flack from some guys that may be on the teams, but like, I can just tell that both of you guys are not the kind of guys that are just trying to build up your egos or that you have an ego or anything like that. So I've just been super impressed by that side of it.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I really do. Absolutely. And it is, and you know, we talked a little bit about that today.
Yeah,
on the Can-Am ride back from the range, and it's a weird situation. Mm-hmm. It's how do I do this the right way?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do I do this the way that's not selling out or I don't know, I guess being boastful or
right.
Know, that type of thing. And it is a pretty difficult thing in my mind to figure that out.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But the other part of that is I absolutely 100% enjoy instructing. I mean, that's what I did for, you know, the last, you know, part of my career at training detachment was try to pass on knowledge. And you're trying to pass on knowledge to hopefully save somebody's life, to hopefully, you know, these guys that you're giving this knowledge to,
mm-hmm.
won't make mistakes that will cost them their lives. You know, it's like, it's super, super rewarding
right.
to do that.
Yeah. And I think there's a right way and a wrong way to go about it. And I guess, unfortunately, some people have gone about it the wrong way, where it's kind of self-serving, and it's very clear to me that that this here is not self-serving whatsoever. So,
I
wanted to express that. Yeah.
Thanks.
Anyways, sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, it's okay. Okay, so now I kind of lost my train of thought, but okay, so going back to the teams, you know, I've done almost every job there is to do in the teams. You know, I've done STVs. I've been a breacher. Of course, I've been a sniper. Been a dog guy. You know, I learned how to handle the canines that we use on operations. Been a pilot. Done a lot of things, and I got to be a sniper instructor for a couple of the sniper courses, and doing that, like anytime you are tasked to instruct something, it makes you dive deeper into what you're instructing, because number one you don't want to look like a jackass, you don't want to look like you don't know what you're talking about in front of, you know, other team guys, so that motivates you to dive into the topic that you're about to instruct. So instructing sniper school is, for me, it was not as difficult, but it was pretty, pretty eye-opening. Like I'm about to give a class on whatever, and it's like, well, I better know my shit when I give this class. Because if you stand in front of a bunch of team guys and you try to bullshit, they see right through that right away. And then you just lose credibility, and nobody will listen to you after that. So, going through sniper school, number one, it was super tough. It's probably one of the toughest courses I've been through. And other snipers will tell you the same thing. It's not easy. It's I can't remember how many weeks it was, but it's a couple months at least, maybe even 3 months of doing the job as a sniper. Shooting every day, like every day you're on the range from 100 yards to 1,000 yards. And, you know, you're doing quals, you're stalking. And, for stalking is basically you are trying to sneak up on people on binos. And, you know, when we did it, we would shoot blanks. And then the guys on the binos, you have walkers out in the field. They're directing the walkers. If they think they see you, they direct the walkers to you. And if they do direct the walkers to you, then you fail the stock. And if you fail too many stocks, then you're just out of sniper school. So some guys find stocks pretty easy. I did not. It was
that seems extremely difficult.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, East Coast, West Coast, you know, always this rivalry, right? But on the West Coast, we didn't have timber to stalk in. We literally stalked in the desert. Like, you're on your face trying to sneak up on people in the desert, and all you got is tumbleweeds to hide behind and, you know, stuff like that. So for me, it was pretty difficult. And
is that in broad daylight or?
It's in daylight. Yeah. So basically what they do is they take a truck, and in the bed of the truck, they put a table. Two instructors are on binos looking at the field, and they give you left and right limits. So it's like, hey, you can't go past this right limit. You can't go past this left limit. You start, the starting distance varies. You know, maybe 1,000 yards, maybe, you know, more, longer, shorter, depending on the terrain. But it's like, hey, you have this amount of time to get up to 200 yards, take a shot. If you're successful on that first shot, without the instructors walking somebody on you, then you got time to, you know, you rechamber around, you take a second shot. And if they don't walk the walker on you after the second shot, then you get a 10 on the stock. But at any time, if they catch you coming up, you're done. You're off the field. Pick up your shit and leave the field, and you get a 5. So
you
fail.
Is there like enough terrain to where you can actually hide, like use a ditch or a creek bottom or something like that?
Yeah, there's enough, but I said, out on the West Coast, it was actually,
it's pretty wide open.
Yeah, it was pretty tough. Like, you're literally on your face for 3 to 4 hours, like just crawling
snail's pace,
on your face with your gun in a bag, you know, tied to your belt, mm-hmm. that you're dragging behind you, and then you got to get to your final firing position. You know, hey, I got this big bush, looks great.
Have you ever wanted to have Levi Morgan, Andy May, Johnny Stewart, and others available at all times? Well, you can with Cyber Scout from Spartan Forge. Cyber Scout is like the ChatGPT for outdoors men and women. You can ask it any questions related to bow building, scouting, hunting, survival, and a whole lot more. I think you'll be impressed with how it responds. Cyber Scout is currently out now for a select group of early beta testers and will be available to the rest of you really soon. The entire app is a complete tool for planning your hunt with incredible aerial imagery mapping, journaling, deer prediction, and some of the most accurate and detailed weather data. Use the code EASTMEETSWEST to save 20%. And if you're still on the fence, give the 14-day free trial a chance at SpartanForge.ai. CVA has been America's number one selling muzzleloader brand for over a decade. Hunting with a muzzleloader opens up a ton of hunting opportunities across the U.S., and I've been using the Acura series. But they don't only make badass muzzleloaders. Their line of centerfire rifles are great quality and not terrible on the wallet. The Cascade short barrel is ideal for tight quarters, deer drives, and quick shots in the big woods. You can check out their line of muzzleloaders, rifles, and accessories for every season and every range at bpioutdoors.com/CVA. If you use the code EASTMEETSWEST10, you'll get 10% off of all CVA products, which includes rifles, muzzleloaders, and accessories.
Pull your gun up, get everything set, come up on your scope and be like, I can't see shit. So then you got to pack everything back up, try to find a different place to go to, and do the whole thing over again until you do find a position where you could take that shot. And it was blanks, you know, you're shooting blanks.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, not even now, like they started incorporating live shots where you take your blank shot. If the instructors don't find you, then they put a target where they're sitting. They leave the area, and then you take a second shot that's a live shot, and you have to hit that target, and that's part of your score too.
Huh. What separated guys that from the guys that were getting like seen versus the guys that were passing that part of the course?
I think the biggest thing would be to be able to read the terrain.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, the truck is 1,000 yards over in this direction. And you know, when you start, back then we had ghillie suits, you know, the big woolly looking suits, right? So you start in this one area and the instructor's like, hey, you got 15 minutes to ghillie up, which means you take veg from the area, tie it into your ghillie suit. But you also have that 15 minutes to be like, okay, the truck's over here. I might have a like a ravine on this side, or I got some really good vegetation on this side. And what separated people was being able to read, okay, if I go on the right, I got all this good terrain. But if I go on the left, hey, there's literally a ditch that I could take all the way up to my final firing position. Mm-hmm. And the guys that were smart would go find that ditch and get up there.
I feel like that's one of the most applicable things to hunting yeah. scenario yeah. that like yeah. you could possibly have. Because yeah. it's like you're making those decisions. If you're spotting stalking an elk or something like that, like you're making that decision so quick and trying to just glancing at the terrain and figuring out, yeah. okay, I need to go this way to keep things, barriers in front of me visually, but also like keep the wind in my favor.
Yeah. Using dead space. Yeah. That's a big thing, you know?
Sounds like antelope hunting.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
super it's flat. It looks flat when you look from a distance, and then you'll find a ditch that gives you gains 200 yards that you're out of their sight. Were you collecting your brass when you were,
Actually, you were. I'm not lying. Like you would take that shot and you would do the old sniper, you know, pull the bolt back and catch your brass in your fingers. Because if you left anything, it was like minus points. Like if you left, you ate a Snickers bar and you left your Snickers bar and somebody found it, it'd be like, hey man, minus point. Or, you know, talking about resting your barrel on, you know, like how we're shooting positions, like, hey, don't rest your barrel on something because of the harmonics. If the instructor saw that your barrel's resting on a branch or something like that, it's like, hey, your barrel's resting on that minus 1 point, you know, stuff like that. Yeah, it was not an easy course. It was, but I loved it. You know, once passing sniper school, once instructing sniper school, it was the job that I wanted to do, you know.
Wait, dude, when you were talking about the ghillie suit, isn't that what you were wearing when we came in earlier? Don't you just wear that all day, every day?
Yeah, pretty much.
That's what I thought.
I'm just kidding. This is coming from the guy with the long hair and the mustache.
Basically.
I thought you, when you took your shirt off the other day, I thought you were wearing a ghillie suit.
No. That's just being a man.
I got a question for you. I'm going to ask several just dumb questions throughout this thing to keep it light. But so you were on the SDV teams,
yeah.
Which is, I guess, can you explain kind of what that is in a for SEALs?
So an SDV is it's a sealed delivery vehicle, and it's basically a mini submarine, but it's a wet submarine, which means once it goes in the water, the whole thing fills with water. And then you're basically on some type of breathing apparatus, mm-hmm. whether it's the rebreather that's on your chest, or the boat has boat air with scuba lines that you put on your face and breathe like scuba.
Mm. What's your take on the homemade sub that imploded going over Titanic? Would you have gotten on that submarine?
Absolutely not. I've told you guys that, this last 2 days, there's certain things that I'm never going to do again in my life. Number one is dive. Absolutely never, ever will I dive again. And then number two is jump out of an airplane.
You ever been spearfishing?
Yeah, probably a couple times.
You wouldn't do that again?
No.
Man.
No, not even if the lobsters were like that big. Never.
Never going to the beach again.
No. I mean, what I will do is get on a boat, like if deep sea fishing or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I can still handle that. But even getting splashed by the water on the boat, it's that's not cool.
Is that purely from buds or from your experience?
That's probably more from SDV team.
Yeah.
Yeah, just the... That was brutal. That was a brutal job.
Yeah, that's literally my worst nightmare, being trapped inside like a little tin can.
Yeah, you're
underwater for...
If you're claustrophobic in the slightest, that job ain't for you.
And you said you were underwater for like 14 hours?
Yeah, I think my longest dive was 14 hours. Yeah,
that's crazy.
And we did those type of dives all the time, 12 hours, 14 hours, 8 hours. Like a short dive would be 4 hours.
Really?
Yeah. That's a short dive. That's the kind of dives you wanted to do, but yeah.
That's wild. I'm curious, so you said your dad was serving in the military.
Yeah, he was in the Army.
He was in the Army.
Yep.
Was it always just kind of the thing that you thought you were going to do? You were going to go into the military, or was there something that kind of triggered you to want to be a SEAL?
It was probably always the military was... probably always something that I was going to do,
mm-hmm.
whether it be Army, Marines, whatever. That was more than likely the path that I was going to go down. But of all things, I read a book about, and it was probably more fiction than fact,
mm-hmm.
about a SEAL that went to Vietnam. I'm like, that's it. That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
And then, I was probably a sophomore in high school when I read that book. And it's like, okay, that's what I want to do. And then even back then, nobody knew what a SEAL was even. It's like, hey, what do you want to do? I want to be a SEAL. Well, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
And then back then it would be like, well, it's kind of like a Green Beret, but in the Navy. And people would be like, they have that? It's like, yeah, they have that. But now, I mean, you can't, shit, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a Navy SEAL. So
what was... what was your path getting there? Did you enlisted, went to basic, and then straight to
SEAL
training? Or
so, freshman, sophomore year, that's what I wanted to do. My mom, who is she's a great woman, but very, very strict. I mean, she's Korean. I don't know if you guys know about the Korean culture at all, but it's like, you ever heard dragon moms, like super strict, things were, she said, this is how things are. And that's how things were. And so she said, you're going to go to college. And that's how the shit was going to happen. So I wanted to enlist, graduating from high school, I wanted to enlist, go in the Navy. But even my dad's like, no, you're going to go to school first. So went to the University of Colorado, graduated, See, I think I graduated in July for some reason. I think I was like a semester behind or something. I had to take a Spanish class to graduate. Graduated in July, and I left in August of 91 for boot camp. And I don't know if it was the easiest way, but it was probably the easiest way to get a guarantee to go to BUDS was to enlist. Mm-hmm. You know, with a four-year degree, you could probably apply for, you know, to become an officer, do whatever. But to get to BUDS, the easiest way was to enlist. So that's how I did it.
Yeah.
Graduated in July, left for boot camp in August, went to boot camp. And back then, they had three boot camps, not just one, in Great Lakes. So I went to Orlando. And then also back then, SEALs didn't have their own rate. So what you did is you went to school. You went to a Navy school to learn a rate in the Navy, a job in the Navy. So boot camp to radioman A school, I became a radioman. And then that was like 6 weeks long. And then I went to BUDS right after that.
Okay. I feel like BUDS has just this like aura around it, just folklore almost.
Yeah, it's as weird as this sounds, I probably had one of the best times of my life going through BUDS.
Really?
Yeah.
What was your kind of expectation going into it? And then
I thought for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I was going to get my ass kicked. And then the first day I show up, and this somebody that had been to BUDS at BUDS for, you know, probably a week longer than I had, is giving us an orientation. And he's like, hey, you know, on Fridays, sometimes we get off a little bit early because, you know, the instructors, they want to leave. And I was like, what'd you just say? He's like, yeah, on Fridays, sometimes we get off early for the weekend. I was like, we're not working on the weekend? I'm like, hell no, we're not working on the weekend. So that was like kind of eye-opening for me. I thought it was like 7 days
lockdown.
A week. Yeah. But we got our weekends off, so that was pretty cool.
I guess then when you went in, I feel like there's tons of books about it now. But
yeah, I mean there were a few. Actually, the movie Navy SEALs came out back then too.
Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, Charlie Sheen. That was pretty much the first Navy SEAL movie.
Yeah.
That came out.
It's a great actor to have.
I'm curious, what's the book that you were talking about that you read that kind of sparked that fire?
I believe it was called Mekong. It was about this SEAL that. Or about this dude that, and it's kind of weird, but he, once again, it's probably more fiction than fact, mm-hmm. but this guy, during the Vietnam War, he's like, hey, I'm about to get drafted, so I'm gonna join the Navy instead of going in the Army. You know, maybe I'll be a little bit safer in the Navy. So he joins the Navy, and then his thing is like, well, there's this training that lasts 6 months long. Maybe I could go into this training and Vietnam will be over by the time I get out of training. Well, the training was BUDS. So he goes through BUDS training and then, you know, of course, gets sent to Vietnam right away. And then it just goes through some ops in Vietnam that he was involved in.
Yeah.
It's like, that's pretty cool shit.
There is one thing from BUDS that you felt like was the most difficult for you. Is there one individual thing or is it more just like the buildup of...
I think the worst thing for me in BUDS was waking up every morning. Every time I woke up, I'm like, oh, fuck. But once you got started, it was like, okay, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock wake up every morning. It was just like, oh, man, I want to go back to bed.
And like, so when you're going through those days, like I'm sure some are longer than others and everything, but was there like anything that you kind of, whether you told yourself or anything kind of mentally just to get through it, that you have like milestones, like, all right, I get to this time or I do this?
Yeah, I mean, I think most people, you just need to think evolution to evolution. You know, like, hey, I got a 4 mile run. Okay, I need to finish this 4 mile run. That's it. Mm-hmm. And then after that 4 mile run, it's like, okay, we got some type of PT. Okay, all I need to do is finish that PT. And then, hey, we're going to go to chow. Awesome. And then the next evolution, it's like not looking at the long game. It's looking at the short game. It's looking at, hey, all I got to do is finish this day. And then the next day it's like, okay, I got to wake up and I got to, you know, do a 2 mile swim. Okay. I just need to pass this swim instead of looking for, you know.
Oh yeah. Like yeah. I have five things to do today that are going to be difficult. You look at it from
or looking path. at the, at more like the end goal. Hey, I got 6 months.
Yeah, six months, and then a week. It's right. How am I ever going to get through all of this
stuff? It's just, hey, evolution. And once again, I mean, it might be a strange thing, but I had a good time in Buds. It's like you show up, no responsibility. You do what they tell you to do. You're with a bunch of good dudes, and it was just a good time.
Yeah. I like how you explain that with like the evolution, because I feel like, again, coming back to hunting, that's so applicable. When you go on, you know, especially going like backcountry hunts, or you're doing some of these things, like, yeah, you're there to enjoy it, but it's tough at times, and you especially you're there for a couple weeks at a time or do whatever. It's like, all right, basically gotta lace my boots on. I always just look at it, it's like, all right, I gotta get to
just
the top.
Climb to the top of this
top
hill.
Of this hill, and I can do this thing. And then, you know, then there's the next task, and you just kind of go through those things and break it up. Versus, oh, I need to hike, you know, this far and do that throughout the day. So I just think that's like such an applicable thing, and you know, I see it all the time from good hunters, and I've interviewed hunters throughout this podcast, and it's like they always have this one thing in common, is that they just go until the end. They just don't quit. They just do the thing, you know, over and over again, and eventually, you know, things work out.
Yeah, it's super easy to get discouraged hunting, because it's like nothing's going on. You're not seeing any animals. Like, you're just feel like you're sitting up on top of a mountain looking through glass for 5 days straight, and then it's, you know, 30 seconds could be the difference between a successful hunt versus, you know, going a whole week without accomplishing anything.
Yeah.
But if you just give up after those first 4 days and don't see it through to the end, it's like you can cut yourself short by kind of being overwhelmed by the whole picture. But I think another part of it that's relatable is, like, part of the draw for me to doing some more of these adventure hunts and Western hunts is almost embracing the suckiness of it, and just like going out and camping out in the mountains and having to hike in carrying a heavy pack. And like, if you don't enjoy that aspect of it, you're probably going to just like get in your own head and just feel sorry for yourself and just not enjoy it, and then just end up like telling yourself it's not worth it and turning around. And so I feel like probably a lot of the guys that go into Buds with that mentality of like just always feeling sorry for themselves, just not enjoying those things, probably just end up saying, you know what, forget
it. And the other thing is, I mean, you got to look at Buds as like, Buds is not the goal, you know?
Right.
Being a SEAL is the goal. Buds is the obstacle to becoming a SEAL. So you just got to look at it like, if a guy says, yeah, I want to try to finish Buds. It's like, well, that's not the goal.
Right, yeah.
The goal is to be a SEAL, not to finish training. It's to do the job.
Yeah.
And there's, I can't even tell you the amount of times where the actual job sucked more than Buds, you know? Right. And that's why it's so hard. It's because they you know, if you're going to quit when shit gets hard, then you're going to quit, you know? So that's why it's so hard, because you want to weed out those people that are going to quit when it gets hard. So when it actually does get hard, which is there's times in being a SEAL or in combat where shit was hard, harder than Buds, and you don't quit, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And you can't have guys next to you that you're relying on
that
have that mentality.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think another thing I kind of wanted to transition to here a little bit is talking about the shooting aspect specifically, and kind of talking about that, because, you know, I've spent my whole life hunting, and I've shot guns since I was a little kid. Well, both Kurt and I have, to speak from us and our families, big on shooting guns and everything. But, you know, coming to this course and learning from you guys was super interesting, because a lot of the things I felt like that you talked about and went through and discussed, they weren't overly complex.
It's the basics
thing. Yeah. They weren't overly complex things. You know, you think it's, you know, these, you know, shortcuts, and obviously there was a ton of things that were like, that I was like, oh, I didn't think about that or go through it. But from your standpoint and what you've learned shooting, what is something that you consider that makes someone a good shooter? Like, how would you, what are some things people do that you would consider?
Well, there's a saying out there is, professionals concentrate on the basics, right? So whether it's, you know, long range shooting, whether it's pistol shooting, you know, whatever endeavor you're doing, the professionals concentrate on the basics and they get the basics down 100%. Because, you know, say you want to be a good pistol shooter, right? Well, you can't skip doing the basics and be a good pistol shooter, or you can't skip being the basics and be a good, you know, long range shooter. It's all about professionals do the basics over and over and over again until they're perfect. And then the other advanced stuff you can lay on top of that, you know, you can add it later, or you can learn other advanced stuff later, but you always have to go back to the basics. You know, like, you know, we talked about the fundamentals of shooting, body position, breathing, you know, all those different fundamentals. If you don't have those, then how can you add other stuff on top of that? Does that make sense to you guys? Yeah.
No, 100%. I mean, that's so applicable to archery too. I mean, it's just building those fundamentals up and doing it over and over. Like, I remember, you know, you were talking with Kurt we were joking about like how when he jacks a shell.
Oh, yeah.
Goes to grab the... Grab the brass.
Gun over, grab the brass.
Yeah, and then you're like, don't do that.
That was the joke earlier when I said, did you guys collect your brass? Because every time I'd shoot, I'd just open the bolt slowly and grab, because I'm a reloader, and he'd be like, no, just open the bolt, let it go. Like, get ready for the next shot.
Yeah, but you got it. I mean, you were doing it.
I don't know if it'll stick, but I got it today. Well,
you got to decide it's going to make it stick.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too, is like... And this applies to other things, you know, not just long range shooting, but, you know, people are like, well,
I'm shooting a new bow this year and I am pumped. After playing around with a buddy's Hoyt RX8, the smile on my face made the decision for me. The first thing I noticed with the new Hoyts were their extremely smooth draw cycles and the ability to adjust the back wall to make it rock solid like I prefer. I outfitted my own RX8 with the inline accessories that made installation extremely easy and balanced out the bow. My favorite accessory so far is a simple one. It's the Go Sticks 2.0 adjustable legs to make your bow like a tripod, but it doesn't interfere with any part of the bow or the limbs or anything like that. In addition, the integrated kickstand within the HBX Exact cams protect your string from excess wear when you put your cam into the dirt. Ground hunting or spot and stalk just got easier. If you want to experience what I'm talking about, head to your nearest Hoyt dealer and take a test drive yourself. You can learn more at Hoyt.com. The Mobile Hunters Expo is a consumer-based hunting show unlike any other. It provides an interactive learning experience where you can try all things mobile hunting and learn from the best in the business. Come experience an unbiased, community-based environment where you can improve your hunting skills and find the right equipment for your needs. I'll be speaking at the Nor'easter Show in Mannheim, Pennsylvania at Spooky Nook Sports from August 9th to 11th, 2024. So come check it out or either of the other shows in Michigan and Georgia. You can purchase tickets online at themobilehuntersexpo.com. Or grab tickets at the door. I'll see you there.
I have the muscle memory to do it this way. And it's like, okay, yeah, you have the muscle memory to do it. Maybe not the correct way, but you have that muscle memory. And all it takes is a conscious decision to do it the right way. It doesn't, you know, people say, well, you know, it's muscle memory. It's muscle memory. But if you make that conscious decision not to do that, then you're not going to do it. Does that make sense again?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some people use muscle memory as an excuse. You know what I mean? It's like, well, I've done it this way the whole time. Well, just stop doing it that way. Just stop.
Yeah.
Make the conscious decision to stop doing it. I don't want to say the wrong way, but not the right way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it is also, it was interesting because, like, you know, not that I expected to come in here and it'd be like, oh, there's this certain secret that every time you shoot and you do these things, but you know, the way that you guys looked at it was everything was situational. You go through the basics, you figure out what you have to work with and make it work. Because like, you know, we started out and we were shooting, you know, after we went through the classroom stuff, we went through the med brief and the safety stuff and everything there, you know, we go out in the flat range and, you know, showed us how to, you know, set up our rifles and make sure the scope was mounted correctly and go through all these things. Then we go in the flat range and start by practicing in perfect conditions and doing that right. And, you know, from what, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what you were saying is like, you know, you want to learn to have the best case scenario as far as making sure your body was positioned mm-hmm. right and your breathing was right. And, you know, your gun and you understand how your gun and your ammo and everything's working correctly. And then, so then when you have to adapt in different situations, yeah. you can make that.
Yeah, because work. I mean, in all honesty, how many hunting situations, like rifle shooting situations, are you going to be proned out on a bipod with a bag underneath, you know, your stock and you know, everything's perfect? Probably never.
Yeah.
You know, but if you still work the basics, you know, your breathing, your trigger, maybe that will help you out if your body position, you know, like you're in some kind of awkward position that's the only position you can get into. So maybe your body position's not perfect, but everything else that you've been working on that's basic is still good. So you're going to make that good shot, you know?
I'll say that, like, having shot a lot my whole life, and, like, I was looking for, like, trying to maybe there's one thing that's just, like, the secret there. But it ended up being, like, this culmination of things that just, like, improved. So everybody knows, and it's the same with archery. You're kind of timing that figure eight with mm-hmm. with when you break that trigger or when you break the release. And one thing that I know, it didn't hit me to with the power line today, but it was like, just from what I've learned here, I significantly reduced the size of that figure eight to the point where it was like I'm watching my heartbeat just like mm-hmm. move yeah. the crosshair. And then in your timing on that minuscule scale, where as opposed to where it was like say at 500 yards it might have been 4 or 5 feet, I was reducing it down to 8-10 inches on that target. And it was like just doing that, it's like even when I did not time it correctly, it was still only a few inches or so off. But yeah. it was like the fact that you're able to get into those positions and make those small adjustments of arm position, like, hey, try this, do it, because it is a little, it was, some of the stuff was a little non-standard from the traditional shooting, especially like shooting from a knee. Mm-hmm. Like, you're always told, I mean, growing up, it was always left leg up to support your support hand. But if you have something supporting the front of your rifle, like the right leg up makes yeah. a lot more sense to support the hand that's running the back of the rifle. And it was, I don't know, but reducing that movement was, well, it kind of blew my mind a little bit.
Well, it was hard. So actually, Kurt, just to correct you a little bit on the archery standpoint, it's different because in archery, you're not supposed to time anything. You kind of let it float. And as you're pulling through, it's wherever your shot breaks. So it's different because you're kind of using your back muscles to be able to help, and you're not really pulling the trigger. You're more kind of pulling through, and it just breaks surprisingly where, you know, based on some of the instruction here, it was like, okay, you are kind of timing that and making sure with your breathing and having it. So it took me a little bit to train my mind differently with shooting with it. And there's no better feeling when you hear that hit that steel plate. Like, that's that we were just joking about it at dinner or talking about it, but it's like you can't have a course like this without those steel plates yeah. when you hear that yeah, that feedback. Awesome. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Is that accurate what Bo's saying? Like, in archery, I guess the phrase is accepting the pin float.
Yeah.
Who's it? Joel Turner that kind of goes really yeah. gets into that. But like, it's impossible to hold your pin yeah. perfectly still.
It's the same with, I mean, it's definitely the same with pistol shooting and yeah. shooting a carbine. It's like if you try to time it, or say you're shooting a pistol, right? And you got that little wobble or float or whatever. And all of a sudden you say, now That's what happens is push now.
It. Yeah.
And you're pushing that shot, right? And same with the carbine and you know, same with the sniper rifle. If you consciously say now, then a lot of times you're gonna push that shot where you don't want it to go.
Yeah.
So you do accept it, but you just, you know, you do everything to minimize that movement that's going on.
Yeah. I've always had issues of kind of like drawing a bow and kind of freezing under the target and then trying to pull up into the target and then timing that release. But after listening to like Joel and Levi and a few other guys, I've like really focused on drawing and aiming at the same time to where like I'm immediately trying to get on target and I'm not, it's almost like I'm afraid to aim at the target. And I think it's kind of the same thing with the rifle. It's like you're trying to find your target, you're trying to get the reticle on there. And if you think about it too much and you're like trying to time it up, you end up just jerking past it or pushing down forward. But if you just accept kind of having that reticle float around the target, you eventually kind of get that muscle memory. And like what you're talking about, you figure out like the best way to brace yourself, and that float just gets tighter and tighter and tighter to where you're just, your deviation is just smaller and smaller.
Yeah. And then utilizing the things that you have available to stable yourself to make that not happen with the gun. Like, you know, that was probably one of the biggest takeaways for me, was like using things like your tracking pole on the backside and using these different things to have multiple points of contact to be able to have and do that. Like, I just never thought of being able to do that, and having you guys instruct us through it and getting to do that was just like, that was incredible.
Well, that's one of those things, talk about muscle memory. If you don't train those things at the range in a hunting situation, when you're about to make a shot on an animal, like you're not going to think about grabbing your trekking pole out of your pack and using that as a brace for the back, for the buttstock.
Yeah.
Like you got, cause you're going to think you have to rush in that moment and just end up shooting stuff, like rushing your shot. But if you train the things like we did today, using your pack, trekking pole, whatever else, like,
and that is one of the biggest things. Like, you know, super, super lucky to have the job that I had where I could go to the range and literally shoot 1,000 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like it's nothing. Literally, you shoot 1,000 rounds, like nothing. And I know, you know, most civilians cannot do that at all. So I know I've been super lucky to have the job where, like I told some of you guys, I'm surprised people paid me to do that job. I would have paid somebody else. I would have paid the government to do that. It's like, you're giving me a paycheck to do this? It's like, holy crap, man.
Yeah.
I do this for free.
Yeah.
Well, that's why we're fortunate that you're willing to teach this stuff. Like, that's... get somebody with that experience to show us that has those, at this point, hundreds of thousands of rounds, probably even more than that downrange. So like what you've learned from that, you can only learn from putting that much, having that much time spent behind it and like picking up the little things. And a lot of the stuff that you might not even think makes a big difference. And like the way you speak about things might just set a light bulb off in somebody's head. That's like, oh, that's what he meant by that.
I mean, it's always good to have different instructors too, because I could try to teach you something over and over and over again, and then somebody else says that thing in a different way, and you're like, oh, okay, now I understand it. It's like, why couldn't you say it that way, Twan? It's like, I don't know. I did say it that way.
Well, Kurt, you're talking about like you're looking for that one little secret that's going to change the way you shoot. You're very experienced. You're a gunsmith. I'm an archery guy. Like, I have very little experience and very little instruction on a rifle. And I was, when I first started, I guess yesterday, sighting in the rifle, I was wrapping my thumb all the way around the grip, and I was pretty inconsistent. And then I watched Twan shoot, and you shoot with your thumb out, and you're almost like barely even gripping the rifle. It's almost like your hand's just resting on the foregrip. And it's just there so that you can pull the trigger.
Right.
And when I tried that grip, it made all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
Because I guess I just wasn't putting that kind of that side pressure on the rifle as I was squeezing the trigger. So I mean, for someone like me that's a total noob, having someone that can just point a little thing out like that, like I could have never realized what I was doing and would just, you know, could have struggled trying to figure out, like, why am I not consistent?
Well, but, I mean, my first shot string I did, he's like, hey, I noticed your finger isn't consistent in the same spot on the trigger. And yeah. I'm just like, why? Like, yeah, I don't, without somebody sitting there from the third person and seeing that, like, I'm thinking about so many other things. And then after that, it was like a simple, like, hey, make sure it's in the same spot every time. Like, almost like a little checklist you're going through yeah. in your head. And then ever since he said that, it was, now I'm like, okay, middle of the pad of the finger, mm-hmm. which is one of the first things you learn when you're shooting a rifle, but it's just, you do it so much, you kind of get into bad habits or whatever. And it just, it's like, it was nice to be regrounded. Like, oh yeah, that's like, that's basic marksmanship.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, you listed off in some of the earlier stuff, like the fundamentals of making an accurate shot, and trigger control is one of them, obviously. And everybody thinks trigger control is just applying pressure and pulling back, but it's also position of your finger, position of your hand, all of that. So yeah, that was, I mean, I guess that was one of those, like, aha moments.
Yeah. For someone that just doesn't really know anything.
For me too. Yeah. Yeah. It's,
well, yeah. And I think, and also from my standpoint, like, I've been a big fan. Anybody that's listened to my podcast before knows that, like, I'm a huge fan of doing in-person courses, or just, and usually that's because, so my goal is, like, I want to surround myself by people that are really good at certain things that I want to be good at to be able to learn more. And usually that's through the form of courses, you know, in person or however that may be. And it's just, you learn so much from that, you know, that's outside of the curriculum, and you get to talk through it. And what I liked was, you know, Tuan, you have some, you know, you're showing us some pretty cool rifles that you had built that, you know, are pretty extensive rifles, but it didn't matter because the things that you're teaching aren't always necessarily just about the gear or the rifle. It's about how you can make the most out of what you have. And, you know, you wanted us to be shooting our guns that we're going to be hunting with. You know, we spent a lot of time getting my gun set up for, you know, moose hunt and doing these things, like learning basically, and you can, you know, kind of clarify this, but learning the stuff that you have and getting super familiar with it is going to make you a better marksmanship than just having the best rifle or the best caliber or whatever it might be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, once again, it goes to all shooting. You know, it's like, you got to know your weapon. Like, the trigger pulls on your rifles, you know, you maybe it's 3 pounds, maybe it's 2 pounds, maybe, you know, maybe it's 2 ounces, whatever it is, right? But you got to know your trigger. And you get, it sounds kind of stupid, but you got to be intimate with your trigger, you know? Like, even on my pistols, I know when my pistol is going to break, how much poundage I'm putting on my pistol to make that thing go off. And it's like, I can load it. And you know, we talked about the rifle that I had is like, yeah, I can... I didn't want it to where I just touch it and it goes off. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to feel my finger on that trigger and know, okay, I know where it's going to break, you know? And that's, once again, that's, it's practice and it's consistency, you know, with that saying that we had on the slide, you know, consistency leads to accuracy. And it's absolutely true. If you do consistent, if you practice consistently and you do things in the real world over and over and over in the same manner, then it leads to accuracy. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because even if you're doing a minor thing wrong, if you're doing it the same way wrong every time, you can achieve some sort of accuracy.
Right.
Same deal with archery.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, it honestly doesn't really matter how you grip your release as long as you're doing it the exact same every single time.
Mm-hmm.
If you're putting a little bit of face pressure on the string, like, as long as you do it every time, you're going to be accurate. You're going to be consistent.
Mm. Yeah. And then there's those things that you can do, like, as far as proper technique, that'll make it more consistent.
Sure.
Because, like, certain things like string pressure, it's hard to get the exact same string pressure every time, where if you just, you know, touch your nose on it, again, thinking of archery, touching your nose on the string slightly, it's like, okay, that's more repeatable than something else. So, like, that's where having those fundamentals, or you can do those more consistent. That's why they are, you know, best practices.
Right.
Which goes back to the whole putting my finger in the same place on the trigger. It's like something so simple, but it just affects so many other things down the line of, like, that means my hand's going to be in the same position. It just gets you in the same thought process. Yeah. It's like, littlest thing makes a huge difference in consistency.
Yeah. And then once again, talking about muscle memory, you know, we talked about how to change muscle memory, but as long as you, if you have that muscle memory the right way, then you don't even have to think about it, right? You're in a situation where you gotta shoot that moose or you gotta shoot that elk, and it's a natural thing that happens, you know? It's like you've done it the correct way over and over and over again, so when you have to do it on an animal or for real, it's just natural. Everything falls into place and you do it the correct way.
You just don't even think about it. It's just second nature.
Right.
Yeah. And is that how you think, like, as far as with high stress situations, you feel like that's how you, I guess, are able to fall through with those fundamentals mostly just through that practice? Or what other things, like, with you with, like, high stress situations, how are you dealing with that?
I think we practiced so much. Like, and I'm not going, you know, like long range shooting or sniping or anything, but like, say I'm talking about like CQB entering a house. You have a group of guys, say, you know, you have 4 or 6 guys that you train with every single day for months and months and months and years, and, you know, over and over and over. Like, we would go to the house almost every day. And I'm talking about like the kill house, the practice CQB house, right? You go there every single day and practice and practice and practice, and you critique each other. And the critiques are not like, it's not like we're sitting here having a good time. The critiques are like, hey, dude, you fucked that up. Don't ever do that again. I mean, they were pretty brutal. It's like, or you do a run, and if I mess something up, the first thing that comes up is like, hey, fellas, I screwed that up. I did this when I should have did that. Won't happen again, you know? But going back to the high-stress situations, you work together and practice together so much that it's second nature, you know? It's like, you know, this shit can be going wrong, but it doesn't matter because you know what your brother's going to do, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, if us four go to the kill house every day for a year, then we go into a real situation. It's like, I know what each one of you guys is going to do. And yeah, it's just a team. It's like a dance. Yeah. You just do it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when it is stressful, or, you know, you're getting shot at or something doesn't go as planned, you still work together enough to know that, okay, this didn't go like it's supposed to go, but we can adapt and we could do something different.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And so, With those situations, because I know, like, myself and really anybody that comes into hunting, it's like, you know, they call it the traditional buck fever. Oh, yeah. That you get, and you get the situation, all of a sudden your heart rate's going and you're doing those things. So from your perspective, it's a lot of, or tell me if this is correct, but you think it's a lot of just like doing the thing over and over and over again, that you know what to do in those situations? Or do you practice in trying to make it stressful to be able to adapt to it, or do you think it's more of like the doing the basics so much?
I've always wanted to ask this question to someone like Tuan.
Yeah.
Like, does your experience in the military, especially as a sniper, is that like a similar feeling in those high pressure situations as like a hunting situation? And obviously it's nowhere close to the same consequences or anything like that, but is your ability to like control your breathing and your heart rate and all that kind of stuff, does that translate over into a hunting situation, or is it totally, totally different?
No, I know what you're saying. I, for me personally, I mean, this is just me and my personal outlook. I absolutely think it does. Mm-hmm. It's like, would my heart rate go to 180 and I'd start shaking if I saw, you know, a 200 inch buck walk in front of me? Probably. But I think that I can control it enough to you know, to make a shot on it.
Yeah.
You know, without missing.
Yeah.
Is that kind of the answer to your question? Or
yeah I mean, kind of. I guess to me, from someone that's never experienced anything close to what you've experienced, it seems like it would almost like desensitize you. yeah, being in such a high level of stress to where like shooting a deer is just like, oh, whatever, I'm just pulling the trigger almost. Not that you lose the excitement of like the hunt,
right,
the chase, but
right,
that just like adrenaline dump is almost.
I mean, there's like anytime I'm in a deer stand or I'm, you know, doing a hunt and I see an animal, there's definitely that little spike.
Yeah.
But I definitely think like if I'm rifle hunting or any type of hunting and the animal comes out, that adrenaline pops up, but then it's just, it's like, okay, I don't want to make this sound like it's something bad, but then it's just like, okay, I know what I need to do, you know, and it's just.
You focus on the job at hand at that point. It.
And I don't want that to sound like a bad thing. You know what I mean? It's taking an animal's life. That's what you want.
That's I feel like that only comes with experience in like shooting animals.
Right.
Cause it's your first like handful. I mean, I still get buck fever and it's almost impossible to control. Cause it's just, you know, it's literally chemicals in your body that are releasing adrenaline.
Right. I think everybody remembers their first year or whatever, where you're just like,
don't remember it. you black out a little bit.
If your dad's with you, he's like, now pick up the gun. And you're like,
yeah.
Now what? Like, it's just.
Because I hear so much conflicting stuff as far as like training for these situations. And like, even with, you know, even when it comes to physical conditioning, like I've went through multiple different phases in, you know, from a physical conditioning standpoint. I went through, you know, online training that was like training for the worst, wanting high heart rate all the time, doing that kind of stuff. And then to like where I'm at now with a trainer that I work with, that's like, he's all about building foundations and doing the same, just consistency over and over again. He's like, then you'll deal with those situations because you built that consistency. But I was always curious from, you know, your perspective of like, do you think like entering high stress, trying to recreate high stress situations in your training to be able to prepare for that? Or is it more so of, again, building that foundation so much that you just revert to that?
I think it's the latter. You're just building, once again, you do the basics so well that it's second nature and it just comes, it just happens. You know?
Have a choice. Yeah. But other than to do it that way.
Right.
Just don't think about
it. Yeah.
So if you're a new guy on the teams or a new sniper, is that something that you guys talk about or train for? Like what you're going to feel when you're in that first combat situation and you have to pull the trigger on something? It's like, or is it just, you don't even want that to enter your headspace because you're just trying to focus on the fundamentals of, you know, shooting and how you're working with your team and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, in all honesty, we probably should talk about that more, but it's you're talking about like the emotional feeling of,
not so much emotional, more the adrenaline dump, because it seems like, to me, it'd just be like overwhelming, especially if you're a sniper and you're like going in on a high value target or something and you've been watching this person for a while. It's like that moment. It's with hunting, it's such a buildup because you could literally be chasing a specific buck for years.
Yeah.
And it just.
And then he comes
out to that one split second. It's like all of that adrenaline is just getting funneled into that one moment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I really don't know how to. Not to answer, but how to express that answer. You know,
yeah.
It's just.
I don't want to get into something that's like
no. Personal or no. We're not at all. It's just not coming to me how to answer that question. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's once again, you work. So when you're doing things in the kennel house, there's really not that much stress on you. You know, I mean, if you're doing live fire shooting, you're shooting next, you know, you're shooting close to each other, mm-hmm. you know, that there could be dangerous things that happen, but it's not like you're going through a selection, you know, it's not like in more induced stress when it's like a selection process. Like going through buds or, you know, going through selection for development group, super high stress. Like the only way they can make the stress higher than what they do is to actually shoot at you when you're trying, you know, when you're doing your job, which obviously they can't. But, you know, it's the fear of failure. You know, you don't want to fail. It's, you know, basically the fear of not doing the job correctly. Mm-hmm. So in selection, super high stress. Once you pass selection, it's training. And in training, there's still stress, but it's not like, you know, you're training to do the job. You're not there. Well, I guess there's always the possibility of getting shit canned if you don't perform, but the stress is not as bad as selection. It's more of, hey, we need to train together to be a group, to be a team, to get this mission done. So there's not that like adrenaline dump every time you go into the kill house when you're training or when you're on the sniper range taking shots. It's not like that. So when the time to do it for real, you've practiced so much, it's just once again, it's just second nature. You just do it. Yeah. And I think even in combat, I've never, it sounds kind of weird, but I've never been afraid for myself, like getting hurt or getting killed or anything like that. The only thing that I ever worried about was not doing my job correctly and causing somebody else to get hurt. That's the only thing that ever made me worried, was like, hey, I have to perform because my brother's life depends on it, you know?
Yeah.
If I get hurt or if I get killed, okay, it is what it is, you know?
Yeah.
But I never wanted to be the reason somebody else got hurt.
No, totally makes sense. What about Drew? What else do you have?
Yeah, I kind of don't know if I answered.
I mean, it's a tough one to answer because, like, it's difficult to put that feeling into words, for me at least, from a hunting situation. But I think what you're saying, just like the only way that I found to kind of like numb that feeling is A, to just shoot a ton to where you're literally just not even thinking about the mechanics of your
right,
shot.
Right. Yeah. Once again, your muscle, I hate saying muscle memory because muscles don't have memory. It's in your brain.
Yeah.
You know, it's the mechanics. Your brain is telling your body to do something. And if you do it over and over and over again, and we talked about that too, like when you were picking up your brass, yep. I told that story about, I think it was the cops in Chicago, shoot their revolver, turn it over, dump the brass out, bend down, pick the brass up over and over and over and over again on the range. And then they get in a shootout for real. They shoot their revolver, you know, shoot all six rounds, open it up, dump the, and this is in, you know, a shootout, you know, with bad guys, dump the brass out, bend down in the middle of a fight and pick their brass up, because that's what they've done over and over and over again. So, you know, you're talking about doing the correct thing over and over and over again, but you could also do the incorrect thing over and over again, and your body will revert to doing that.
Yeah.
It's just a natural, not a natural, but it's a learned behavior that you will do in stressful situations. So if you do the wrong thing over and over, stress hits, your body reverts back to that. Whereas if you do the correct thing over and over and over, when stress hits, you'll do the correct thing.
Yeah.
So
I think one difference, I guess, that's probably important to point out is like the majority of archery shooting that I do is just standing in my backyard on flat ground, shooting a target that's bright red with a white circle in the middle of it. Whereas like buds and SEAL training, they obviously put you in the most stressful situations possible as you're training. So that's probably a pretty good takeaway. And I've learned that the hard way, even just like going out to shoot TAC events at targets that are not on flat ground, like you're shooting at a steep uphill angle or steep downhill angle. It's like, if you don't practice for those situations, if you just sit in your backyard and shoot flat, you're not going to be able to, your muscle memory is not going to take over in that situation.
You guys don't climb up in your tree stands and practice shooting?
I mean, little bit, but not, you know, a few times before season opens.
Well, I started doing that a lot a few years ago because I used to do that, and then I just kind of got, I'm like, oh, it's pretty simple, especially when I'm out shooting. I can shoot, you know, 80, 90 yards at targets on, you know, flat ground. I'm like, I'll be able to shoot 12 yards out of a tree stand. And then I missed a buck at 12 yards, or 14 yards, and it was like an absolute chip shot because I wasn't bending at the waist like I needed to and doing the things. And I was like, I'm an idiot. Like, I knew better that I needed to do that. So now it's like the way I approach like archery is like I'll shoot all summer kind of on the flat range, getting like my mechanic styled and doing that. And then come August, I start I kind of start going away a little bit from like shooting all the longer ranges and stuff. I'll get in my tree and I'll put my 3D target at different angles and different positions and shooting off the different sides and then like
off your knees,
shooting off your knees. Yeah. And then like I'll just walk out and I'll throw arrows out different parts of my yard and guess the range and try to shoot without moving my sight and try to understand what my pin gap is and start to learn those other skills that. Yeah, just because I was good going out there in my Crocs and my shorts and shooting on the flat ground all the time, that wasn't applicable as practicing the skills that were what was realistic.
And
like we were doing like with shooting on the flat range here and then going up to the power line.
Even team guys are guilty of that. You know, you go to a range and you lay your mat out, you get prone behind your bipod and you shoot and you shoot and you shoot and you shoot. And then it's like, okay, put your gun on that window seal. Or put your gun in a weird position, and then it's like, oh, shit. Okay, this is a little different. To where it should probably be the inverse of, hey, you go to the range and shoot, you know, a little bit proned out, nice and comfortable, and then the rest of the time you should be in those, you know, awkward positions or non-standard positions like we were shooting today.
Yeah.
That's what it should be.
Bo, do you ever, like, run or do burpees or something before you shoot to get your heart rate up to try to...
I have done that and I've kind of went away from it just coming back from the idea of what my trainer was talking to me about from a fitness standpoint was said, if you're training your body for specific, this is the way that Todd explained to me is like kind of training your body for high stress and like you almost create a panic. Like when you're doing that sometimes to that, it makes it more difficult, more so if you just work on the foundations of getting your fitness to a level where you're able to slow your heart rate down quicker when you get to a spot and take your time and make a shot versus just doing it when your heart rate's at 180 beats per minute sort of deal. But that's,
is he saying that like, if you increase your fitness level, that it's buck fever is not going to affect your heart rate as much?
No.
Or just if you're hiking in the mountains.
Sort of deal more than anything. And then it's just like, but when it comes down to the buck fever standpoint, it's like, okay, you focus on the way at least I do it, not saying it's correct, but like a deer will come in and you might get that initial panic, but you just kind of let yourself breathe and go down. And then you go through your mechanics. And I do it by talking to myself, like in my head. I don't say it out loud, obviously, but I go through, it's like, all right, get ready, which is like putting my nose on, looking through my peep, lining up the sight picture, looking at the bubble. And it's like, okay, I say, okay. And that's kind of when I just breathe and it's execute and then pull, 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 pull. And I go through my shot process. And by me having to go through those steps, which is a Joel Turner thing I learned from. Mm-hmm. And when I trained with him and it was like, and he's sitting there beating on my hat with an arrow and trying to like get you worked up and, you know, basically kind of talking shit to you a little bit to try to get you worked up but by going through this process and focusing through those things, then you have to focus on saying those things to yourself. So it keeps you in the moment focused on what you're supposed to do. And that helps you execute essentially.
Basically you have a sequence of events that you go through.
Yeah. You have a sequence of events. So that helps take your mind off of your elevated heart rate and doing all these things. And that's kind of how I've approached it. That's just how, again, just me and not saying that's perfect, but
no, I think that's super important to have like a mantra that you're just, once you start that saying in your head, it almost takes your mind off of what's going on in front of you.
Yeah.
And just makes you focus on the mechanics of the shot.
From a rifle standpoint, do you do anything like that or have any things that go through your head when you go to make a shot?
Well, I mean, you know, like we did the demonstration of how I get behind the gun. That's kind of my sequence of
yeah,
basically shooting prone. You know, it's like, hey, my gun's laying there. I'm directly behind my gun. I'm gonna get down to where, you know, basically the buttstock's in the middle of my chest, and then I move it over. You know, get ready. It's probably not as much of a sequence as what you're talking about when you do your bow, but
yeah,
there is kind of a sequence of events.
Yeah. Yep.
It's like, okay, good cheek well, good sight picture. I'm on target, finger on, press.
Yep.
Shot goes off.
Yep. No, totally understand. Is there anything else, Drew, you can think of, or should we go get our tattoos now?
I got some more questions.
You have some more questions?
Yeah. Let's see, where should we go first? Would you say that playing Call of Duty makes you a better operator?
I probably tried Call of Duty one time and got my ass kicked so bad as I can never play.
By some
13-year-old. So that was one of the big things on deployment is like if you weren't operating, like you had a night off or something, dudes would literally I'm definitely not a tech geek, but they would somehow join every TV in like our little hooch area,
yeah,
and have like battle royales of Call of Duty. You know, with the split screen, you know, yeah, 15 people on a split screen. I'm like,
yeah,
what the hell are you guys looking at, man? I can't even follow what you're looking at. So
I mean, answer. I feel like kind of like strategy and like where to, how to use the map. I'm not a gamer. I was in college for a little bit. Like, but.
I guess maybe you could learn some, you know, some tactics from Call of Duty. Yeah.
The consequences are a little lower, but
I don't know.
So, yeah, all right. So the thing is, like, you don't need any of these courses. Screw that. Yeah, just play Call of Duty.
they do have snipers on Call of Duty too, right?
They do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you can swap out your rifle pretty.
It's a lot
quick.
Easier to be good at doing it on there too.
Yeah. You don't have to pick up your brass.
You don't have to pick up your brass. Yeah.
You just respawn if you get shot.
You don't even have to put boots on. It's pretty nice.
I got another question for you.
What do you got?
In a shit hits the fan situation, how many rounds of ammunition would you personally have on hand?
So
let me preface the question.
Yeah, rephrase that one here.
I know people that have like thousands of rounds of ammunition stashed in their basement, but these people aren't military trained. And my mindset is always like, if you get in a situation where you're shooting more than like two magazines, you're screwed. Like in that situation, I want to get the heck out of any sort of conflict and not have to shoot very many rounds.
Yeah. So I look at it and I'm probably one of those weirdos that you're talking about.
Well, it's fair for you because you can actually probably use.
I look at it in two ways. Is one, you might not know how many people you need to shoot, right? So yeah, having more rounds is probably better. And then the other thing is, in a shit hits a fan situation, bullets are going to be like gold. So if you have a chicken and I have bullets and you need bullets, I'd be like, hey, that chicken looks pretty good, man. You want 10 rounds for that chicken? So you could barter with your...
Or you shoot the chicken and you got food too.
That's just always bothered me for some reason. Just guys just stockpiling ammo that it's like, you're not a Navy SEAL sniper.
You're in the wrong room, Drew.
That's true.
Yeah. I think it's just you that doesn't have that.
I think it's just you.
I mean, I have at least somehow.
Everybody else here is like, that's not normal.
Yeah. You don't have?
I'm trying to think what else. What do you, being a Navy SEAL, I'm assuming that you're privy to...
Well, let me back that up. I'm actually retired. I don't know if we ever brought, so I retired 2 years ago.
Okay. Did you ever experience aliens being a Navy SEAL? Because you were a pilot as well. So you were you drove submarines, you're a sniper, and you're a pilot.
So I might have seen some underwater aliens by being delirious or being hypothermic.
Yeah.
So there's a chance I've seen some underwater aliens. As a pilot, I've never seen UFOs or anything. I mean, yeah, none of that stuff. And probably even if I did, I probably couldn't tell you. So
Man, I can't. Yeah. Kind of just negates all my other questions.
No, I'm just talking about the aliens. I can't tell you. You know, if I did know about aliens, I probably couldn't tell you. So.
Okay. Fair enough. That's all I got.
Okay.
That's it. We're ending on aliens.
I think
what is one thing that the average gun owner / hunter can do to improve their shooting, their everyday shooting? What is the biggest mistake you've seen over your time that you can leave people to practice at home or to?
I think probably one of the best things, and this goes from pistol, carbine, even to sniper rifles, is to dry fire. Just to dry fire. You don't need to spend money on bullets or money going to a range or anything like that. I mean, you can dry fire in your living room, you know. That goes, once again, from pistol to carbine to even your sniper rifle. Just getting behind your gun, going through the basics, and dry firing.
What about shooting like a small cat, like a 22 or something like
that? Yeah, that.
Don't mix the two. Don't dry fire 22s unless your manual says you can dry fire 22s.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Or I'll fix it for you and charge you lots of money.
Huh. Okay.
But regular guns are almost
just
all regular.
I fire my bow over and over again. that works.
That's how you got so good?
Yeah, that's how I got so good.
So pistol shooting, like, I was terrible pistol shot. I'm still not great, but I'm a lot better because I literally spent hours and hours of just watching that front sight and getting it to break where that front sight didn't dip down every time it broke.
Yeah, dry fire.
And that's, right? Dry fire.
Yeah, that's the first thing when I just bought a new 10 millimeter to take to Alaska. That's what Kurt was telling me. He's like, just sit there and just feel that trigger out and just learn it.
It sounds stupid, but you got to be intimate with your trigger. Pistol, rifle, whatever, you got to know your trigger. You got to know when it's going to break, all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
I like the, and this probably goes for pistol shooters, rifle shooters, all of it. The best in the world dry fire all the time. That's how they become the best in the world, is by dry firing.
And are you literally just like, sometimes I have my pistol in my truck, and if I'm on a long drive, I'll take the magazine out and just sit there, cock it, dry fire. Are you talking about just dry firing without focusing on like form and aiming, or are you going through drill?
Yeah, you're going through drills. Okay. Yeah, you can go on the internet and find, you know, a million dry fire pistol drills, like, you know, like those little pasties that we shot to sight in. You know, put a pasty on the wall start at 3 yards. You know, and I'm talking about with a pistol.
Yeah.
There's other drills with a rifle, like even just getting in those non-standard shooting positions and dry firing in those non-standard shooting positions. It's going to make you 100 times better.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that.
Yeah.
I mean, you said with the 22, like all I want to do now, since I know I can't just do this every day, although I wish I could, like my 22, I'm just going to be shooting in these kind of positions all the time now, just practicing like, how do I get in this awkward position? How do I get it as stable as possible?
And in my, you know, twisted gun brain is, you know, I built that 6.5. So now I want to build a 22 exactly like that 6.5, so I can shoot 22.
Yeah.
You know, not that I'm wasting 6.5 ammo, but it's cheaper, you know. So I could have a gun that's exactly like a hunting gun, or, you know, a replica of a bigger caliber that I could, you know,
yeah,
go outside and shoot and practice with.
Yeah, I had a guy on the podcast a while back that named Michael Shea. He wrote a book about 22s, and he was telling me, you know, because when I first got my Brigara, I think, and he's like, you can get basically a replica of that in a 22 and just practice shooting that, so you can just like get the feel for it and just kind of plink and go through and get good at it.
Yeah, but once again, I mean, you don't even have to do that. You can dry fire too.
Do you have to wear face paint when you dry fire?
Yes.
Okay. In a ghillie suit.
Yeah, in a ghillie suit.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure I had all the gear. Anything else, Drew?
I don't think so. No, that's all I got.
Okay. Well, anyone that's listening, you can find Guardian Precision right now on Instagram. And if by the time this comes out, if there's anything else, throw it in the intro as far as and in the show notes where they can find everything that had to do with this course, because man, it's been really, really fun the last couple of days of getting to learn from you guys and just shooting. Like, I just can't put enough emphasis on just being around you guys and getting to hang out and ask questions and just everything that comes along with something like this and the experience and even just the other guys that you get to be with and in these types of scenarios. Yeah, just, absolutely. It's so awesome.
Yeah.
No matter the experience level. Like, yeah. It is. Yeah. Everybody picks something up.
Yeah, for sure. I've told you this, but I think just like a big part of this experience is getting to hang out with guys like you that have 30 years of experience in the military at the top level, going through sniper school, instructing sniper school, and just being around you from someone from my level of just inexperience with rifles. Like, I absorbed a lot more than you probably realize, literally just watching you. And so I think that's extremely valuable. You know, it takes just a little bit of an instruction and just like being around in that environment, being able to ask questions and literally just, you know, you watching us shoot a couple times and be like, hey, just try this, tweak this a little bit. And it's, you know, something as small as that can make a huge difference.
Well, I mean, I appreciate the opportunity. Once again, it was awesome.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
No, and now you can look in all of our Instagram bios and it'll say SEAL trained sniper.
With tattoos.
Yeah. Tattoos, yeah. Yeah. I'll have a full sleeve here by the time I fly home tomorrow. Awesome. So
it'll awesome. Be henna, but it'll be
yeah. We'll be good. All right. Well, Twan, thank you for everything.
Once again, it was great. It was a good time.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit eastmeetswesthunt.com, Facebook at East Meets West Outdoors, and Instagram at East Meets West Hunt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please review and subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.